he was able to see. However, as a dome-topped disc came to rest, hovering just above the ground near the truck. On the ground by the craft were three humanoid entities, two men and a woman. They had long blonde hair and elongated eyes, and wore silver, one-piece suits with high boots, no helmets, no weapons. After the entities had talked among themselves, one of them lifted Lanka by the neck of his sweater. Lanka was desperately frightened, but the man put a small black box against his left index finger and instantly he began to relax. In a few seconds, he was unconscious. The next morning he awakened on the roadside and made his way back to civilization. He told his story and investigation was undertaken, but although competent doctors used hypnotherapy and truth serum with Lanka, he could not remember a portion of his experiences aboard the craft. He was able to tell the investigators that these entities had been contacting people on Earth since 1950, and that their purpose was to discover whether Earthmen could live in their world. He described the interior of the ship, and said that he went into the ship not by stairs or a ramp, but on a ray of light. But he reported that the beings did not want him to remember some of his experience aboard their craft, and he would not be able to. The message that came from him after intense probing for information was this: I have a message from the beings in the craft, but I can't tell you what it is. No matter what you or any other Earth scientists do, there will remain the memory lapse while I was on the ship. The medical personnel working on this case agree with this statement, and feel that to probe any deeper in Lanka's subconscious for this experience might damage his health. But they feel that his experience was, though unbelievable, quite real. Case number 8. Date, the 1st of July 1974. Place, Warneton, Belgium. Investigators, MSSRS. Bazin Senior and Junior, Mr. Bighorn, Mr. Boydin, MUFON investigators. An anonymous witness driving along the French-Belgian border experienced engine failure. His lights and radio also went out. At this point he saw a landed UFO about 160 yards away across a field. The 30-foot-wide craft was shaped like a World War I British helmet and was glowing a patchy orange, with white light coming from beneath it. Two entities were walking slowly and stiffly toward the witness. Both were about 4 feet tall, with grayish skin, round eyes, a rudimentary nose, and a slit-like, lipless mouth. They wore helmets and metallic gray coverall-type uniforms. One had an object in his hand shaped like a short, thick ruler with a pointed tip. He was aiming it at the car. When the beings came to within 12 feet of the car, one of them opened and closed his mouth and the witness felt a slight shock at the back of his head and heard a low-pitched, modulated sound. Then the entities turned about and reboarded their craft, which began pulsating an electric blue glow. Its tripod legs withdrew, it rose and hovered momentarily, then rapidly ascended at a 60-degree angle. As the witness prepared to leave the site, another car drove up. Its driver had also seen the UFO and the beings. Case number 9. Date, Easter Sunday, 1974. Place, Bardstown, Key. Investigators, Lawrence Allison and D.T. Elkins. A boy in his late teens was driving alone at night and wondering why he was doing so. He had almost compulsively gone out to take the ride and had no purpose in mind, when a man appeared beside him in the car. He asked the startled boy if he remembered him, which he did not. Then suddenly he was inside a large room, he and his car. The passenger welcomed him aboard, and proceeded to show the boy around the craft. After the tour was completed, the guide, who looked like a normal Earthman and was casually dressed in a shirt and blue jeans, asked him to get back into his car. The boy did so and found himself suddenly back on the road. Investigations to find more details of this encounter are continuing. Case number 10. Date, the 4th of October 1974. Place, White House, Ohio. Investigators, Earl Neff and Larry Moers, MUFON field investigators. Sam, an alias, had spent an evening with a friend who claimed to be a contactee of the UFOs. During this meeting, He had asked the contactee for proof of the UFO's reality. On the way home from work the next night, shortly after midnight, his car's engine and light died. As he got out of the car, he noticed another car stop behind him. A very prosperous-looking, gray-haired man got out of the car and came over to him. This normal-looking human then offered Sam proof by dematerializing a rock with a small handheld implement. Then he told Sam to save his marriage, and promised that he would be contacted again. Case number 11. Date, the 26th of May 1974. Place, Mitchell Caverns, California. Investigator, Ida Blipperson, New Funfield investigator. This witness had seen UFOs several times in the past. One evening he was awakened in his camper by a humming sound and pulsating lights. He tried to call his family, but was immobilized. He saw four pinwheels of odd-shaped colored lights, red, orange, yellow, and blue-green. He awoke the next morning with bloodshot eyes and an aching body. It was 2 hours later than his usual rising time. He had impressions of having been inside a UFO, but a memory lapse blocked out details. At a later date, under hypnosis, he recalled being inside the craft and described a row of gyroscopes along an inner wall. The pinwheels of colored lights energized these to form an artificial gravity field. He had seen eight men, normal-looking, seven of them dressed in maroon foil-like uniforms, the eighth clad in a soft, pale blue outfit. He saw a view screen which was showing a close-up view of Saturn, a control panel, and three recliner-type chairs. The entities examined his eyes with a magnifying glass. The witness says that he expects to receive further contacts from these entities. Case number 12. Date, the 9th of March 1974. Place, Duxbury, Mass. Investigator, John Giambrone, New Funfield investigator. One day, early in the morning, this very reluctant woman witnessed a red pulsating UFO at treetop level, and two light beams which shone across the bog caused her car to die, while the radio gave out static. Not long after this incident, the woman got a telepathic message to drive her car down a certain road, which she did. Again the radio and engine quit, but this time four small humanoids appeared, moving rapidly towards her, each astride a small vehicle that looked like a rototiller but moving rapidly above rather than on the ground. One of the entities approached her car and telepathically asked her to open the door, but when she did not comply, all four doors flew open anyway. The entity examined her and touched her on the nape of the neck with a small implement which left five small puncture marks. She was told that they have thousands of ships which have been visiting Earth for many years. They have a mothership nearby, she was told, and their home planet is called Omnius or Omnigus. They have examined many people, not all of them voluntarily. She was asked not to touch them because of possible contamination and was warned that she would have severe headaches for several weeks after this contact. These entities were 4 to 5 feet tall, had helmets on which concealed their faces but through which small, shiny eyes could be seen. They were dressed in uniforms, the belts of which featured an emblem with vertical wavy lines. This witness was terrified by this encounter and has refused to allow any investigation by any group. The details given here were supplied to MUFON in strict anonymity by her husband. This woman denies to any questioner that the event ever occurred. Case number 13. Date, the 25th of October 1974. Place, Medicine Bow National Park, Wyoming. Investigators, Dr. Leo Sprinkle, Professor of Psychology, University of Wyoming, Investigator for APRO and MUFON, Rick Kenyon and Robert Nantx, MUFON Field Investigators, and Frank Pck, National Star Investigator. Carl Higdon was hunting elk in the northern area of the park. He fired at one, but saw his bullet leave the rifle in slow motion and drop to the snow about 50 feet away. Feeling a tingle, he turned and saw a humanoid entity over 6 feet tall standing nearby. The entity wore a black jumpsuit with a wide belt, upon which was a six-pointed star and a yellow emblem. The entity had bristle-like, straight hair standing straight out from his head, small eyes, No eyebrows or chin, bow-legged, long-armed, and with rod-like manipulators instead of hands. He might have had hands, but Higdon never saw them. The entity approached Higdon and asked if he was hungry, and flipped him a little bunch of pills, which Higdon swallowed. Perhaps the entity felt that Higdon would not be hunting unless he needed food. The entity pointed at Higdon, and suddenly Higdon found himself within a transparent, cubical craft in company with two UFO noughts and five elk. They told him they were on their way to their home planet some 163,000 light-years away, and shortly they were there. They had put a helmet with wires sticking out of it on Higdon's head. He saw it all, Seattle Space Needle-type building and a type of sunlight which was very intense and made his eyes water. The entities told him that our sun does the same thing to their eyes. The next thing Higdon remembers is being back in the park, about 2½ hours having elapsed since the first sight of the entity. He was cold, disoriented, and nearly hysterical. His truck was not where he had left it. He found it about 3 miles away, stuck in a mud hole. From here he sent out a distress call over his CB radio, and the sheriff picked him up at midnight. By now, Higdon was in a state of panic and near nervous exhaustion, shouting, "They took my elk." They took him to the hospital and checked him over. Oddly, his blood tests showed a very rich supply of vitamins. Those food pellets must have been nutritive, and old TB scars on his lungs had disappeared. Later investigation found that Higdon's wife and two others had seen a red-green-white flashing light moving back and forth across this area. When Dr. Sprinkle used time regression hypnosis on Higdon, he found out more about his experience. Higdon was able to recall that other Earth people had been present, and he said that the aliens had come to Earth to hunt and fish for food. Case number 14. Date, the 13th of August 1975. Place, Alamogordo, New Mexico. Investigator, National Enquirer, APRO. Staff Sergeant Charles L. Moody, a 32-year-old Air Force man, was parked near Holloman Air Force Base in the desert, watching for a predicted meteor shower, at about 1:20 a.m., when suddenly, like a flash, an object appeared, dropping from the sky about 300 feet away. It stopped about 25 feet above the desert floor and wobbled for a while, then glided toward Moody. As it came closer, Moody could see that it was a disc-shaped craft which glowed a dull, metallic gray. It was 40 to 50 feet across and 18 to 25 feet high, with three globes showing on its underside. The terrified Moody leapt back into his car and tried to escape, but his month-old battery was completely dead. Then the craft halted again, about 50 feet away, and Moody began to hear a high-pitched voice, and to see shadowy figures through a window which had appeared in the craft. Quoting the Inquirer report, "Suddenly an odd glow enveloped my car, and I felt numb all over." Immediately after the experience, this numb feeling was the last thing Moody remembered before coming to, sitting in the car, and watching the craft leave, shooting straight up. But in time, the memory of the hour and 20 minutes he'd lost came back to him. Two beings had come from the craft, gliding rather than walking. They started to open the car door and Moody panicked, striking out at one of the aliens. Then, the lights went out. When he regained consciousness, he was on a table, and an alien was studying him. Moody was unable to move. The alien, which was hairless, large-skulled, with no eyebrows and round, large eyes, small nose, mouth, and ears, and thin lips, spoke, but with no lip movement. He asked if Moody was well, and told him he would release him from the paralysis if he promised not to strike out. Moody agreed, so the frail, 5-foot-tall being in the skin-tight white suit, with whitish-gray skin, touched Moody with a metal rod about 7 inches long and half an inch thick. Instantly, Moody could move freely. Moody asked if he could see the craft's propulsion system, and the alien agreed, so they left the circular room in which the examining table was in, and went through an arched doorway and then into another room, which, Moody reported, seemed almost as large by itself as the whole craft had looked from the outside. It was as though the interior of the ship were larger than the outside. In this room, there were three other beings, one apparently a woman, floating about a quarter inch above the floor. The leader told Moody to stand on a certain part of flooring, and as he did so it dropped, like an elevator, to a room below. Protruding up from the floor of this room were the top sides of the three globes he'd seen on the underside of the craft. The globes contained large crystals, on each side of which were rods which sloped in toward the crystal. The aliens gave him other information too, says Moody. They said that this ship was a small observation craft from a much larger main craft which stayed 5,000 to 6,000 miles out in space. They also told Moody that they would be making themselves known to mankind within 3 years, though they plan only limited contact at first. These aliens belong to a league of races, which our human race may one day be invited to join, if they decide to accept us. But whatever happens, the aliens will never hurt us. After this conversation, Moody was told to report to a medical facility, and he lost consciousness again, to wake up in his car. He watched the craft leave, then easily started his car and went home. Both his wife and his superior officer are convinced that the very conservative Sergeant Moody is telling the truth. Case number 15. Date: the 11th of May 1975. Place: Apache Sitgreaves National Forest, Arizona. Investigators: Coral and Jim Lorenzen, directors of APRO, Dr. James Harder, of Rees, APRO. Travis Walton and six other men had been working in the forest all day, thinning wood with chainsaws. They were riding back to town at about 6 o'clock when they saw a yellowish glow ahead of them and to the right. The truck was on a right-hand curve, and it bumped along until suddenly it came to a clearing, where they had a very clear view of the object causing the glow. It was about 15 feet in diameter and 8 feet high, and was hovering about 15 feet above the ground, about 90 feet from their truck. They were able to estimate the size of the craft because it was hovering over a pile of slash and was about its size. The craft was glowing with a color like a Coleman lantern being lit. When Travis saw the object, he asked the driver to stop, then without waiting for the truck to completely halt, he jumped out and walked quickly over to the pile of slash. The object gave off a beeping noise and began to oscillate around its vertical axis. There were other rumbling noises. Then a bright, narrow ray of greenish-blue light shot out from the craft and struck Walton. A bright, soundless flash surrounded Walton's body and lifted him a foot into the air and backwards, with his head knocked back and his arms outflung. One of the other men saw Walton fall to the ground after this, but all were busy running from the scene. They stopped about a quarter of a mile away, just as a light lifted up through the trees in the direction from which they had just come and streaked away. They decided to go back and find Walton. They were back at the landing site in 15 minutes, but could find no trace of the craft or of Walton. They finally gave up searching and went to the sheriff's office to report the incident and the missing Walton. The sheriff noted later that these men were extremely upset, one even weeping. Later polygraph tests bore out that they were telling the truth about their experience. In the next days, a thorough search, involving about 50 men, was made for Walton. After 2 days, the search was called off, and a missing persons report filed. On November 11, Travis Walton called his sister from a telephone booth in a nearby town. His voice was extremely weak. Her husband and her brother went to find Walton, and discovered him slumped on the floor of the booth from which he had called. He was 12 miles from the spot at which he had last been seen. He had a strange story to relate, and little by little the details were told. When he regained consciousness after being hit by the ray, he was lying on a table in a low-ceilinged room. There was apparatus resting on his lower chest. He had pains in his head and to a lesser extent all over his body. Around him stood three entities, about 5 feet tall, with large eyes, small noses, mouths, and ears, and no hair. They wore brown coveralls. Travis was panicked by the sight of these human fetuses and knocked the apparatus off his chest, striking out at the entities. The creatures calmly left the room, turning right out the doorway. Travis followed them, turning left. He went down the hall and into another room, which featured a transparent wall through which he could see what he thought were stars. He sat in a chair which had push buttons on its arm, and pushed one of the buttons. But the stars then started to move, so he left the buttons alone. A man in a blue outfit and transparent helmet came into the room and beckoned that Walton follow him. He did not answer his questions, but merely led him out of the craft, through an airlock, and down a ramp. He was now in a large enclosure in which several disc-shaped objects were parked. The air was fresher than before, the light brighter. His guide took him into another craft where he met three more humans, two men and a woman, who wore blue clothing but no helmets. They all closely resembled one another. At this point a mask, resembling an oxygen mask, was put over Walton's face, and he lost consciousness. When he regained his senses, he was lying on his back on a road. He felt the heat of a disc-shaped object which was rising into the sky above him, the doors on its bottom just closing. Walton recognized the road, walked unsteadily to the nearest phone, and called his sister. 6 days had elapsed. Tests performed immediately after Walton's return show some dehydration but no malnutrition and no possibility of drug use. The lost time is blocked by a strong memory block, and APRO's careful report stated that it might be months before further information about the lost time can be extracted from Walton's subconscious. This concludes our small sampling of contact cases. These few interesting cases make up only a tiny percentage of the well-documented contact cases, which now number over 2,000. This total increases almost daily. Over 2,000 reliable witnesses have reported contact not only with UFOs but with their occupants. Trained investigators have found these stories to be given in good faith by credible people. Something is happening. Chapter 2. The Telepathic Contact. Do a movie on Yuri. Melanie is the one to do it. Work at it, it will come out at the right time. You are not to entrust anyone with the secret of our existence. No 1.1 This message was received at 2 p.m., April 14, 1972. It appeared as if by magic on Dr. Andrea Puharich's cassette tape recorder, and was alleged to have been transmitted from a UFO. At 1:03 a.m. on August 27, 1972, the following was received in the same manner by Dr. Puharich. One of our failures is that we cannot contact you directly. We can only talk to you through Ari's power on the tape recorder. It is a shame for such a brilliant mind we cannot contact you directly. Maybe in time we shall be able to contact you directly. This afternoon we heard the movie script. It is a brilliant movie but not the story we want. We want you to prepare the Earth for our mass landing, a mass landing on Earth. We landed in South America 3,000 years ago, and we must land again. We want you to tell our story, what you call the UFO experience. Use all the collected data and literature. AP, how do we know which is the relevant or true data? Research the data published. You will know what is correct. Write the movie script carefully, slowly, properly, and cleverly. 26 years earlier, in 1968, I had received essentially the same message, not on a tape recorder but by the direct mental process referred to by the source. I had been experimenting since 1962 with dozens of subjects, pursuing an investigation into the possibility of mental or telepathic contact with UFO sources. By August 1972, when Dr. Puharich was being asked to prepare Earth for a mass landing by producing a movie on the subject, I was already in the middle of producing a motion picture. My reason for doing so, a UFO source had requested the same task of me. The important part of this is that each of us had received the same information, totally independently, and allegedly from a UFO source. In fact, most of the information from the UFO source recorded in the book, Yuri, by Puharich, correlated with the telepathically received data I had accumulated as a result of my own experiments. My own interest in the possibility of telepathic contact with UFO sources stemmed from my original study of the UFO literature of the 1950s. Most of the people who claimed contact with UFOs were considered charlatans or crackpots by the scientific community in general. It seemed to me, however, that this was the historically classic attitude of men of science toward genuinely new ideas. This is true to this day, and was emphatically true then. The numerous contactees of the 50s, as well as many of the more recent contactees, seemed to have a common denominator. Most of them claimed direct, mind-to-mind contact with the aliens, rather than verbal communication. It was not hard to see why the scientific community would be sorely tempted to classify all UFO contacts in a lump under cultist claims because of the metaphysical or religious orientation of most of the messages. On the surface, such contacts seemed like highly imaginative science fiction stories, or like the creations of fanatic cultist groups seeking frantically for their new messiah. What the scientific community chose to overlook was the independence of many of the claims from other claims of contact, and the extreme degree of consistency in the content of the messages. This independence was a fact in several of my own contact experiments. The participants did not know when they started what their goal was or what they should expect to happen to them. The messages which they eventually produced were extremely consistent in content with other alleged UFO messages. I have found increasing numbers of functioning contact groups around the country, in Canada and England, and elsewhere in the world. And in addition to the growing number of voluntary contacts, one can come across many sincerely told stories of involuntary contact. An example of this which has been well documented is Herb Skirmer's story. Skirmer, a highway patrolman in the Midwest, reported sighting a flying saucer during a routine patrol in 1967. The Condon Committee heard of this and put him through time regression hypnosis. Under hypnosis, Skirmer recounted contact with the UFOnauts themselves, rather than a simple sighting of a flying saucer. Repeated testing of Skirmer's memory only proved that he sincerely believed that his story of contact with extraterrestrials was true. The Condon Committee people could not shake his faith in what he remembered of the UFOnauts. Herb Skirmer's story is told rather fully by an investigating reporter who seemed well versed in this area. He offered a list of general observations regarding the UFO contactees. Among his points was this one, concerning the way the contactee allegedly receives his messages from the UFOnauts. While he is being interviewed or questioned, the contactee often seems to be listening to another voice or presence in the room. Often there are pauses in his conversation which last as long as 45 seconds to a minute. After this pause, the answer to a query is given with great lucidity. In interview sessions wherein the contactee has been hypnotically regressed to the time of contact, he begins his entranced recreation of the experience in normal hypnotic voice trance patterns. When he reaches the time when the message was relayed to him, usually after the mental and physical examination, his voice and manner changes, even under hypnotic trance, and he recites, rather than recalls, the dogma which saucer people have relayed to him. 3. I recognized this description of the contactee's manner when speaking as messengers for alleged UFOnauts as being similar to the style of speaking used by all of the telepathic receivers that I had investigated. Another extremely apartment description of this telepathic contact is found in John Fuller's book, Interrupted Journey. Included in this volume is a great deal of directly transcribed and quoted material from the file of Betty and Barney Hill. They had gone to a psychiatrist with anxiety problems. The doctor had performed time regression hypnosis on both of them, and uncovered an alleged contact with the UFO people. When Barney was asked to recall the language used by the UFOnaut, Barney stated that the being did not speak to him by word, but told him what to do by the alien's thoughts, making his thoughts understand. When the psychiatrist asked Barney if this was some kind of mental telepathy, Barney said that he did not know the definition of the word telepathy, yet he described its process quite well. It seems to me to be rather an exaggeration of scientific caution to declare, as so many did, that all of the people who claimed this telepathic communication were suffering from identical forms of mental aberration. The more appropriate response seemed to me to be to attempt to check this common denominator out.